Welcome to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We're listening to some Death Cab for Cutie, a new song called Gold Rush. Listening in with King County Executive and former rock and roll DJ Dal Constantine. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. Executive, Ben Gibbard says they're digging for gold in my neighborhood for what they say is the greater good, but all I see is a long goodbye, a requiem for a skyline. And he told NPR about how Seattle's been transformed with the tech boom and the rise of Amazon. Would you have played this song on KCMU?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
it's back.
Turn it back up. Yeah. I mean, I've lived here a lot longer than anybody in Death Cab. And
yeah.
I've seen a lot of change here and know exactly the feeling of loss when everything you've taken for granted suddenly starts to move around you. On the other hand, this is not the most tectonic change that's ever happened here. I mean, 150 years ago, the native peoples were watching a place that they'd called home from time immemorial be taken away from them, and everything turned on its head, and the gold rush, and various Boeing booms over the years, including during the Second World War. This is a place that has changed radically over and over again. In our day, we should be aware of the lessons from those changes and figure out how to help the people who already live here be able to prosper and benefit from that change rather than being run over by it.
Interesting you say that. In fact, the video has Ben Gibbard basically being run over by by mobs of people. And we're going to, of course, going to talk about Seattle's head tax that came and went. But just on the topic of the gold rush and being overrun, you and I were talking before the microphones opened about wanting to not kill jobs, to encourage jobs. And do you ever feel a conflict about your job in a way is to bring in jobs and encourage growth, and yet you just described some of the ways that growth runs us over?
Yeah. Having jobs, creating jobs, good sustainable jobs is necessary but insufficient to ensuring that every person has the opportunity to succeed. We have to go all the way back to the start of their lives to ensure that they are getting healthy development as kids, a solid education, the kind of training and higher ed and connections to the emerging economy that's going to allow them to succeed. And there have been periods that were relatively stable where you could count on being able to get a certain level of training and then get a job and be secure and succeed. And there have been times of radical change, and we're in one of those moments of radical change. We can't simply wish it away. We can't hope that the mid-20th century will come back. It's not coming back.
Well,
we have to figure out how people can grab onto this economic story and succeed.
The city of Seattle reacted to some of the downsides of this radical change. If you accept that premise that one of the downsides is a lack of affordability and homelessness, the city responded with a head tax, and then there was a well-funded repeal effort. The council repealed that tax. You didn't support the head tax to begin with, right?
No. You know, I think the key to us getting ahead of homelessness is really for all sectors of the community to join together, which is why we created One Table. We have to have the business community and the philanthropic community, including all the philanthropies that grew up out of this 21st century success we've had globally, as well as governments and the providers and individuals in the community and traditional institutions as well, the churches and the chambers and so forth. They all need to be at the same table and agreeing on the approach we're going to take, and then everyone picking up their part of it. When we're pitted against each other, we are taking ourselves away from that necessary conversation.
But are you saying no business tax unless business says yes, tax me?
Would it be good to have an additional $40 million or whatever dollars a year? Sure. Is that going to solve the problem? Absolutely not. What is going to solve the problem is business stepping up and saying, we agree this is our part of this deal. We are going to do the following things in helping connect people to jobs, in creating the space for housing or shelter, in contributing to driving down behavioral health challenges and so forth. And we need that kind of cooperation, and it needs to be region-wide and not just Seattle. And so that is what Mayor Durkan, Mayor Backus of Auburn, and I are putting back together as the conversation around a regional solution to homelessness.
Yeah, this is the One Table Group, which I was reading in the Seattle Times about this, that it sounds like nothing's happening. The former head of the county's homeless agency said, I think everybody's in the dark as to what's next with One Table.
Well, a lot had happened, and then their, you know, conversation obviously got diverted into this sort of Seattle-centric conversation around the head tax. But we have a set of, I think, pretty significant findings around the housing shortfall, what's needed to deal with behavioral health, which includes both addiction and mental illness. The critical step of making it so that no one exits a system into homelessness. So when people are coming out of the criminal justice system or out of the mental health system or out of the foster system, they don't just drop into the streets. They have a transition plan and someone to walk through that transition with them. And then jobs. Because in the end, if you're able-bodied, if you're capable of working, you need to be able to get a job and take care of yourself. And that is, you know, something that often kind of ends up being overlooked in our conversation about housing and the other barriers people have. Fundamentally, the thing's going to work when people are able to earn a living and rent a place or buy a place.
Are you advocating any new taxes in King County?
We're going to, I think, over time need additional resources in order to get ahead of this challenge. I mean, the challenges we're dealing with are mostly not locally generated. These are national and global issues around income inequality and the new economy and national tax policy. But we have a bunch of resources right now that we can deploy to much greater effect, I believe. And we are also going to need to examine where are there long-term shortfalls, whether it's in capital for housing for those who can't respond to the market, or whether it's in programs and services for those who have challenges that need to be dealt with.
I think you said you want new tax money, right?
We need to have a conversation about what that is, because the only authority we have region-wide right now is a sales tax or a property tax. And I think most people would agree that those sources have been oversubscribed, in particular in the wake of the McCleary solution from the state legislature on property taxes. But, you know, the legislature needs to engage with us around what a fair, equitable, and adequate funding source would be.
Are you calling for an income tax?
To take on and get ahead of this. Last year, the legislature considered a capital gains tax to replace part of their property tax increase, and it came very close to passing. The Seattle Times editorialized previously in favor of a capital gains tax. It would be fairer. It's not ideal. It's not a complete solution to the inequities in Washington's tax system. But we need to move towards something where people are paying their fair share and not either more than they should be paying or less. And when people feel that they're being treated fairly, even though no one wants to pay taxes, they'll be willing to shoulder a little extra burden to help out in a challenge like homelessness.
Are you a homeowner yourself, renter?
I'm a homeowner.
What are your property taxes like?
I think they're high. They're many thousands of dollars. I was just working on my taxes not too long ago, so I do know how much they are. But the fact is that because the way the property values have gone crazy here in King County, a lot of the tax burden for the state has shifted to Seattle and King County neighborhoods. And that's not reflective of people's ability to pay. And I think I probably have complained about this to you before, but it's fair to tax people when they have increased wealth, but it should be taxed when they realize that, not displace them from their homes, not cause neighborhoods to become unstable because people can no longer afford to pay the taxes because they're now on fixed incomes. You know, they bought this house a long time ago. They helped build this community. The world's changing around them, but it is important to maintain the ties that bind them to one another, to family, to community, to institutions, in order that we can have stable society.
You know, I'm talking with King County Executive Dow Constantine. We passed a hotel-motel tax in 1967 to build 67. The King Dome. Now we're using it to pay off CenturyLink Field. Mm-hmm. After that's done, you want to spend $190 million in taxpayer money to keep Safeco going for another 20 years? Why do the Mariners need taxpayer money?
So, yeah, the hotel-motel tax was established to pay for sports facilities, and has been doing that since 1967. All of the money currently is going to pay off CenturyLink. We went to the legislature and got the legislature to broaden the uses of the money so that we could use 37.5% of it for low-income housing, housing between for people between 30% and 80% of median income, and for arts, heritage, and culture, 37.5% for arts, heritage, and culture, and the remaining 25% for tourism, visitor-related stuff. And the Safeco Field, the publicly owned ballpark, which is now 2 decades old, is, I think, the second biggest tourist draw right after the Pike Place Market in our region. Brings a lot of people and a lot of money to our region, and it is publicly owned. So the Public Facilities District that owns Safeco Field negotiated a lease with the Mariners. They got quite a few concessions, including some pretty strong guarantees the team would be here for another 25 years. And the agreement is that the Mariners, the Public Facilities District from parking and other taxes, some of these tourist taxes that are paid by visitors here would go to keep the place standing, just for the basic systems, not for the amenities that have been bandied about.
Not for luxury boxes.
Not for luxury boxes or brew pubs or anything like that. For steel and air conditioning and wiring and plumbing, that sort of thing that a normal landlord would need to maintain in their building.
This is King County Councilor Dave Opthegrove talking with Q13. For some reason, they're having this interview in front of a fountain, so set that aside. But this is how they talked about this hotel motel tax to Safeco Field.
The Mariners are a profitable private business that can and should pay for their own expenses, but most importantly, there are higher priority uses for those dollars. State law allows us to use that same money if we want to fund affordable housing programs, and right now it's so hard to live in this region. So for me, it's really a question of values and priorities. Do we spend this in ways that help working people be able to afford to live in the region, or we provide $180 million to a single company?
We can't do everything. Prioritize affordable housing over Safeco Field. Why not?
Well, first of all, I think that people in the visitor industry would disagree with him that all the money is available for affordable housing. They're quite clear that this money that was coming in from their patrons, from hotel guests, at least some of it, needs to go to keep people visiting our region.
Can't you move money from one pocket to another?
But second of all, the fact is that we own this building. The public owns this building. And whether your tenant is profitable or not, there are certain things you need to do in order to maintain the building. And the Public Facilities District got a bunch of, I think, really good concessions and clarifications from the Mariners. And they determined that this was the appropriate public contribution to keep the building standing. And I think, they've taken a very different approach than other cities have. First of all, they didn't have this big showdown where they're, you know, the moving vans and they're going to be threatening and coercing. But second of all, they've made a commitment, the Public Facilities District Board, to maintain this ballpark over the long term rather than what's happening in the majority of places now. These ballparks become disposable. They build them 20 or 25 years later, they tear them down and build a new one and another new one, another new one. And I think that is that stewardship is an approach that people probably prefer here. The Mariners are doing well or doing poorly.
Uh-huh. Your timing is excellent.
Yeah, they need a tenant. The Public Facilities District needs a tenant in this building. And I think that it is a fair and reasonable allocation of the costs and the risks among the various parties.
And this hotel motel tax use for Safeco Field, that's not going to voters, right?
No, it's county action. It's about 12%, I think. So
do you think voters would agree with you if they had a chance to say?
Yeah, I think so. In the first year,
what if the Mariners lost 12 in a row in July?
That could be a problem. In the first year, the King County will receive $36 million, which I think $4 million would go to pay for the basic systems upkeep at Safeco Field, $13.5 million for housing, $13.5 million for arts, heritage, culture.
World Cup in Seattle?
Yeah.
Net absolutely. Benefit or, oh my God, here comes an expensive steamroller?
I mean, I think net benefit in large part because we've already built a lot of the infrastructure. And I mentioned this last week during the announcement. You know, we're building this high-capacity rail system. We have built CenturyLink Field, where the event would happen. We are building the infrastructure already to serve our needs that will allow us to have this scale of event, and there will be a tremendous net benefit, not all of it through tax coffers, but a lot of folks will be able to make money off this in addition to enjoying it. And I think it's a great thing for our region. We're going to make a very strong bid to have some of those matches happen here in Seattle and King County.
We're talking on Friday how the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that Washington State's on the hook to fix these culverts that block up salmon from trying to swim through, the state's on the hook, maybe $2 billion. And the former attorney general was telling us that local governments, county governments, for example, have four times that many culverts to deal with. Is this going to be a budget buster that we're going to be talking about?
No, I mean, we found out about this challenge long before the lawsuit was completed, we have been stepping up to figure out where the culverts are that block the most fish passage and how we can marshal our resources to deal with that. Because getting rid of those fish, the blockage of those fish passages is completely consistent with our policies as a county. We want
you
to
backed
do that.
The tribes on this, not the state of Washington's
yeah,
attorney
general. I mean,
general.
For two reasons. One, first of all, the action of opening up more salmon habitat and restoring the salmon runs is very consistent with our work. That is what we do. It's part of our mission. And we want to do it as a team with tribes, with the state, and others. But second, I believe that the tribes' right to fish is meaningless if they have no ability to affect the habitat that causes the fish to exist.
That was the theory of the ruling. Right?
Yeah. And the state's position was that tribes had nothing to say about what happened off of sort of the federally recognized tribal lands. But if you have a treaty right to fish, you have to have something to say about whether what we're doing that caused the fish to thrive or to become extinct. You just have to. It's illogical to think of it any other way.
That's our time for today. King County Executive Dow Constantine. Mariners, 20 games above 500. Weird, right?
And still not in first place.
And still not in first place. The Houston Astros.
It's a tough draw, the folks in our division. But yeah.
So, end of the longest postseason drought in all of baseball, or July collapse?
No, I think they've got it going on. I think that they have a good team with good chemistry. And even if we can't catch the Stros at the end, we're in a strong position to get a wild card berth.
Former KCMU DJ, he's had to move on. Fortunately, he landed in the King County executive job. So you're
going to
be
back.
Okay.
I'm happy to go back anytime.
Okay. We'll go back into the communications building. UW campus radio station together.
It was glamorous.
It was so glamorous. It's The Record on KUOW. Back in a moment. KUOW is The Record. You want to be part of this radio show? Because we're taping the Week in Review live on Thursday evening in Bellevue. I'm going to be there. I'm Bill Radke. I'm going to be there with our Week in Review panel, all chatting with you at the Bellevue Arts Museum on Thursday. A free event. So just take yourself to kuow.org/engage. It says Week in Review Live Tour there. Just click there and RSVP for the Bellevue show on Thursday. You can get into the museum for free, 6 o'clock, and the show starts at 7:30. A fun show, so come say hi to us this Thursday at Bellevue Arts Museum. Now, our next story this hour, when the University of Washington brings a controversial speaker to campus, things can get heated, sometimes violent. Last year, a man was shot on campus outside a speech by the right-wing provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos. It's expensive for the UW to hire security officers for these events. So when the college Republicans decided to hold a rally with the conservative group Patriot Prayer in February, the school tried to send the bill to the college Republicans for security. But that attempt has failed. The college Republicans filed a free speech lawsuit, and the university has now settled the case. Here to tell you more, our University of Washington law professor, Eric Schnapper. Welcome, Professor. And president of the college Republicans, Chevy Swanson. Welcome, Chevy.
Glad to be here.
First, Professor Schnapper, you and more than 20 other law professors wrote a letter to the university asking President Anna Marie Causse to settle the case. Why did you argue for the university to settle?
Well, the issue in this case is one that's come up in the Supreme Court many years ago and was fairly clearly settled at that time. The problem is what is known as a heckler's veto. The question is whether a speaker can be prevented from speaking because someone will show up who doesn't like what they say and get out of hand.
Thus driving up the security costs and then making it prohibitive to have a controversial event.
Right. Well, the first way it came up was when cities tried to cancel speeches because there would be objections to it. And that actually came up at the University of Mississippi, which tried to keep people from coming, the civil rights leaders, because they would be controversial. It came up again in circumstances very much like what happened here in Forsyth County, Georgia, about 30 years ago. There'd been a demonstration there that had been driven back by violent white protesters. The civil rights groups then came back. The county had to spend several hundred thousand dollars, and then they adopt to protect them from the violence. And then they adopted a local law under which they would charge people to protect them from violence. And the Supreme Court said they couldn't do that. Yeah. So that was the question here. The problem here was not whether the Patriot Prayer Group, the issue wasn't whether they were going to be violent. The concern on the part of the university was that they would be attacked by others, and they wanted to charge Patriot Prayer and the Republicans to protect them.
So now, after the settlement of this lawsuit, college Republicans basically have won that fight. Can the UW not charge any security fee, or it just has to be quote-unquote reasonable?
Well, there are different kinds of security fees. So insofar as there was a concern on the part of the university that a speaker would be attacked by others, whether a guest of the Young Republicans or the College Democrats or anybody else, the university has decided not to charge for that and agreed not to do so. If there were a concern that a speaker were going to come and urge his supporters to attack others, that's a different matter. But the university, the College Republicans haven't proposed to do that. I think that would be a different problem. And constitutionally, I think the university could charge for that, but that's not the issue here.
Chevy, you were president of the UW College Republicans last year and again this school year. How has the university's security fees affected the way your club planned events or who you've invited to speak?
Yeah, these fees have affected our events greatly. Actually, we were going to bring Joey Gibson earlier in the year, and we were getting into planning of that, and they had started talking security fees very early on into that, and ultimately, that was one of a few factors why we had to cancel that specific event. So it was already affecting our operations, already affecting our ability to bring speakers and bring events, and it was always in our mind when we were trying to invite people, and it was having a profound effect on what we were able to do on campus.
So how does the settlement affect who you're going to bring in? Who are you going to bring in because of this this settlement of the lawsuit?
Well, we're in planning of that, and you're not going to get any specific names for me, of course, but it gives us options.
Does it rhyme with Stephen Miller?
That name has been floated, but I will not confirm or deny any people that we're inviting or thinking of inviting. But yes, it gives us a lot of options, and it does now feel like we could bring anyone we want as long as they're willing to come out and we're willing to pay for the room. I don't know exactly what that's going to look like in the coming years, but it could only be good for the club. It'll only be good for all the clubs on campus because, I mean, remember that this policy affects everyone now. And even if the fees weren't as bad for progressive groups, they did still have to pay security at times. And so I think this is going to be good for all of the groups on campus. And I think the important thing here is that this is going to affect other campuses and other schools because there's sort of not necessarily a case law. There's not case law. There's no legal precedent exactly here. But there's definitely situational precedent that this is a case that can be won by college students. And I think more clubs are going to take up this case and get a lawyer and take up very similar cases on their campuses.
Okay.
That's the goal here.
Professor, does this mean taxpayers will pay for security or that the university just might not provide any campus security at all for an event? It's a free-for-all?
I'm sure the university will provide security.
Yeah.
And taxpayers or most of the university budget aren't from taxpayers, but the university will pick up those costs. That's totally appropriate. The university is here to provide a forum where people can exchange ideas. Not it's limited to ideas I agree with or Chevy agrees with, but whatever ideas they want to express or hear, And insecurity occasionally is just a cost of doing business. The university's pressed for funds. They'd rather have it for other purposes, but this is part of our job here at the university to provide that for them. And when their expenses, that's what we're here to do.
Okay, so then Chevy Swanson of UW College Republicans, if, let's say if Trump, you, and you won't confirm this, you said it's been bandied about, if Trump advisor Stephen Miller came, one of the architects of Trump's zero tolerance policy of separating kids from their parents at the border and more, you could imagine what that, what the protest around that might be, how violent that might get. Is there no one too controversial for you to bring in, too dangerous?
Well, I think it's a loaded question to say that if we were, and we're saying big ifs here,
yes,
bring in a Trump advisor, would that be too controversial? We're talking someone who advises the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. If that's too controversial, I think that's on the people complaining, not so much us for inviting a advisor to the president of the United States. And again, we're talking big ifs here and big specific scenarios. But no, I don't think we would have a problem with inviting him.
What about Richard Spencer? What about Nazis? What about, you know, do you personally have a line that you draw, Chevy, that college Republicans draw about who you wouldn't bring into campus?
Well, obviously we wouldn't invite Richard Spencer. We don't agree with him. Mm-hmm.
Do you personally agree with everything any speaker you brings in says?
I don't have to agree with everything, but it's a crazy question to say, are you going to invite Richard Spencer? No, of course not. Of course we're not going to invite Richard Spencer. But, you know, if he goes to college campuses on his own without groups inviting him, and the law is going to apply to him too. But no, we're not going to invite Richard Spencer. That's a crazy question.
Okay. Professor, is there any line the university should draw when it comes to who gets to speak on college campus?
There would be circumstances when the university could decide not to let somebody come speak. I'm not sure that would, I think in principle, everyone would agree on that. The university has an obligation to provide protection for everyone on campus. And if a speaker wanted to come here who was going to urge violence directed at minority students, for example, or LGBTQ students, I think the university could and should stop that. We have to protect everyone here. And there have been campuses where it has been dangerous for black students to walk across campus. We don't want to let that happen. I have no reason to think that the College Republicans would ask that sort of speaker. I think if the College Republicans wanted to ask Stephen Miller, I think that would be exactly the sort of person that ought to go to a college campus. They're expressing views that are at the center of the national debate. And if the College Republicans are in agreement with the president's position on snatching babies, that they're free to do that. And my hope would be not that it would, I wouldn't go along with your assumption there would be violence. I can imagine a substantial number of people turning out for another event at the same time expressing different point of view. And having lived through the—
That's true. I don't know that there'd be violence.
Yeah. I think having lived through the Vietnam War era, that was very much where the great debates were happening when people went to campuses. So I think that would be totally appropriate.
The UW president, Anna Maria Causse, said last year, there are, quote, there are people who really want me to promise that I can keep them safe. I can't make that promise.
Well, I don't know the context in which she said that. I wouldn't try to figure out what that meant. Hmm. Let me just say, based on what I know, what's happened internally, I think she's very committed to free speech at this. I think she understands this issue. I think we all understand this issue better than we did a year ago. I think she and the College Republicans are on the same wavelength on this one now.
College Republicans, President Chevy Swanson, do you get any sense as to whether the heat, the temperature is coming down or up among when it comes to campus speech and the protests around it?
Definitely down for sure.
Why do you say that?
Well, there are just less protests on campus, and when they are, they're much smaller. Now, of course, a controversial event brings out more protesters than when they do their own events, I'd say. But over the last year, year and a half, maybe 2 years, I feel that the number of people going out and protesting, and specifically the number of people who I would consider or would probably consider themselves part of the Antifa movement, have seemed to be less, just a lot less of them.
That sound right to you, Professor?
From personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't have information on that.
Yeah. Okay. We've been telling you about the settlement of this this free speech lawsuit. University of Washington has agreed not to charge a, in this case, it was a $17,000 security fee for this February campus rally. They there'll be rallies to come. And either the it'll be the University of Washington paying, unless College Republicans, for example, specifically requests security, then that would be a different matter.
No. They're entitled to be protected from a hostile audience, and they're entitled to ask for that protection.
And they won't have to pay in any case.
That's the agreement. Oh. I think that's the right answer.
Okay, good. That's cleared up. And we don't know who's coming to campus. We're not naming names, but Chevy Swanson of College Republicans, that's his department, and we'll follow it together. Chevy, thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
And University of Washington Law Professor Eric Schnapper, thanks for this.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be right back in a moment. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. A listener asked KUOW whether more people are using public lands in Washington. The answer is yes, any way you measure it. More people are buying recreation passes, hiking trails, using campgrounds. That is squeezing tribes with treaty rights to hunt and gather on open and unclaimed lands. That's a quote, open and unclaimed lands. Reporting for EarthFix, Eilish O'Neill headed out to the Middle Fork of the Snoqualmie River to learn more.
It's 2 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, but the parking lot at the Mailbox Peak Trailhead is almost full. Mailbox is a popular hike east of Seattle.
I was just glad we got a parking spot.
That's Jason Gobin, a member of the Tulalip tribe and its fish and wildlife director. He tells me it wasn't always like this.
Before, things were kind of limited to, you know, high clearance vehicles, trucks.
When Gobin was a kid, there wasn't a paved road or nice outhouses here, and there weren't many hikers. Back then, Gobin and his uncles hunted elk and bears around here.
Especially when I was a teenager, my uncles, I'm a big guy, so of course, they would come grab me to go hunting so I could pack the animal out for them, you know. All right, well, you're going too because you can just pick it up and put it on your back and pack it back to the truck and I don't have to do anything.
But Gobin says he hasn't hunted here since the 1990s.
This is an example of an area that just basically got overrun. Nobody goes up here and really hunts anymore. It's become harder and harder to find areas that you can truly hunt.
Here's the thing. The Tulalip and 20 other tribes in the Puget Sound area have a treaty with the U.S. government that reserves their right to hunt and gather, quote, on open and unclaimed lands. The people who signed the treaty thought they were reserving access to one thing, a sparsely populated state chock full of huckleberries, elk, and cedar trees. But today, Washington's open and unclaimed lands are small, shrinking, and crowded.
What I'm talking about is displacement.
Libby Nelson is with the Tulalip Tribe's Treaty Rights Office.
When you and I want to hike and it's too crowded, we go somewhere else. But, you know, tribes' treaty rights are place-based, and they don't have the option of moving out when things get too crowded.
Definitions of open and unclaimed lands vary, but pretty much everyone agrees it includes Forest Service land. In the Pacific Northwest, sales of Forest Service recreation passes have increased by about 50% over the past decade.
Right now, where we've landed is, we don't know if we're going to be able to solve this problem.
Marty Schramm's the Snoqualmie District Ranger for the Mount Baker Snoqualmie National Forest. She says a nearby district has set aside an area for the Tulalip.
They've worked very closely with the Tulalip tribe and have that area available for propagating huckleberries and for the tribe to participate in tribal activities.
Schramm says the Forest Service also consults with tribes before building new roads or trails. And, she says, it can also help if everyone just shows a little respect.
Be aware of how important an area is and how sacred an area is to many of the tribal members that live around here. Nothing drives me more nuts than when I'm out hiking and I come across somebody with their earbuds in and their music turned up really loud.
Back in the Middle Fork, Jason Gobin tells me he doesn't go bear hunting these days, and not just because of the overcrowding of public lands.
My wife doesn't allow me to anymore. She likes bears, so it's like, okay, well, I guess I can't do that anymore.
But Gobin does still hunt deer, elk, and birds.
I'm getting old enough to where I got all my little young nephews, throwing them in the back of the truck, telling them all the stories and, you know, and teaching them how to respect your animals and the different things that you need to do to, you know, pay homage to them, you know, for the sacrifice if you are hunting, you know, and you do happen to get something.
Gobin says he hopes, with a little planning, future generations of Tulalip can still feel that connection to their food. In the Middle Fork Valley, I'm Alicia Neal.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW. We're live tweeting the program at KUOW. The ACLU and some community activists delivered more than 150,000 signatures to Amazon's doorstep yesterday, right to the spheres. The petition asks Amazon to stop selling its facial recognition software to local law enforcement agencies. These groups are worried the tool could be used for widespread identification and tracking, could target people of color, immigrants, civil society organizations. Amazon shareholders also sent a letter last week with the same request. Shareholders. Amazon is not the only one in hot water, either over a controversial government contract. Microsoft and Google have both come under fire recently for who they've chosen to work with. We'll get into that. Todd Bishop is with me. He's the co-founder and editor of Seattle's tech news site, GeekWire. Welcome back, Todd.
Thank you, Bill.
First of all, this Amazon facial recognition tool, it's called Recognition with a K. How does it work?
This is one of many emerging artificial intelligence tools that use machine learning to do things that computers could not do in the past. In this case, what recognition does is it can scan images of faces and essentially detect patterns with superpowers on a level that humans could not, and in doing so, identify individual people and essentially allow law enforcement agencies to see, for example, if someone was at this intersection on one day, the same person might have been at the other intersection on another day, and they can use their existing surveillance systems to analyze the images using this recognition software and see patterns that they might not otherwise see.
Okay, so theoretically, a law enforcement department could use its officers to be very observant about who was in one place one day and the other. If they had many fantastic sketch artists, very accurate. In other words, is the facial recognition software allowing them to police to do anything that they couldn't normally do, or it's just turbocharging it?
It's turbocharging it. It's essentially taking the same types of input, the images that they might get from their surveillance systems or cameras, and allowing the computers to do the work. Now, this is, of course, cloud computing, high levels of artificial intelligence. So this is something that even thousands of humans could not do. We're talking very powerful computers. So
that matters.
To say that it's simply superpowering human abilities is actually somewhat understating it.
Yes.
This is new.
This is a new capability. In effect, this is a new capability.
Absolutely.
And how would these images be linked to what? To names, to immigration status, to what's the concern?
All sorts of things. And that is exactly the question. What could law enforcement do with this? What will they do with this? And it steps into all these issues that each of these tech companies is dealing with, because over the years, they've been very reliant at times on government contracts. But it's a very different thing, for example, when you're supplying cloud computing to the Department of Labor or to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, as Microsoft was in hot water over this week. So this is something very different when you start to get into these types of government contracts.
Yes. Is this, I mentioned the community activists and shareholders too, objecting to law enforcement use of Amazon's facial recognition technology. Is that are Amazon executives worried about this on a business level, that people are looking into their products and demanding a moral stance from a company we mostly associate with kind of libertarian, let the market decide values?
So far, at least, if they are concerned, I'm sure they are concerned at some level, but they have not reached the level of concern that would cause them to back away from offering this recognition software, this cloud computing tool, to law enforcement agencies. And in that way, the difference among the responses from Microsoft and Google and Amazon, it's almost like a Rorschach test, the way that each of these companies has responded differently to the criticism over supplying technology to these agencies.
How so? Have they responded differently?
So Google, for example, was criticized internally and externally for a project called Project Maven, which is a contract between Google and the Pentagon to do much the same thing, supply artificial intelligence that can be used, for example, by drones, by on images collected from drones, to detect patterns. And the concern with Project Maven is that it could be used to execute essentially unmanned killings if the Pentagon decides that, hey, if you see this pattern in the AI data, this is what could happen. You know, you could essentially, without human intervention,
take the shot.
Exactly. And so that is a major concern at Google. Now, the way Google employees reacted was very public. People were resigning. And Google said, okay, we hear you, and we are going to do no further work, extend this contract no further than we've already agreed to with the Pentagon. And that is really in line with Google's longtime philosophy of don't be evil. It's the don't be evil camp.
But is it don't be evil unless you get caught, or are you saying
that's the thing? That's the thing. That's exactly right. And the thing is, in Google's case, they are essentially number three in cloud computing behind Amazon Web Services and Microsoft Azure. And there is a giant contract up for grabs right now with the Pentagon worth potentially billions of dollars. And so by Google essentially taking its future work on this Project Maven off the table, they have put a giant piece of business in jeopardy. And so really what you have here is the business interests of the companies in conflict with many societal interests in terms of making sure that AI doesn't go too far and start making decisions for us. And it's the push and pull. And clearly in Google's case, they felt, at least based on the employee backlash, that they had gone too far.
And where is Redmond in all of this? Where is Microsoft?
Microsoft is a fascinating case. So when this came out about their work with ICE and the fact that they said that they were proud of it back in January when they announced it.
Yeah, will you tell that story, the infamous proud of our work, to support this work?
That's right. Microsoft said in that original announcement about their work with immigration that they were proud of it. And then the backlash started to come amid the reports about the separation of children and families at the border.
I'll read the little bit longer quote for context. This is a blog post in January for Microsoft. The agency is currently, are they talking about ICE? The agency?
Yes.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The agency is currently implementing transformative technologies for homeland security and public safety, and we are proud to support this work.
Right, and we do know that some of the work that Microsoft is doing for immigration and customs is related to this kind of facial recognition and analysis. But in the original statement, they said they were proud of it. Briefly, yesterday, Microsoft took that down, and this was
deleted that phrase?
Yes, exactly. Deleted that section referring to their pride in the contract. After they were called out on social media, and then after Bloomberg News contacted them to say, hey, why'd you take this down? They put it back. Now, Microsoft, to be clear, has not shied away from taking a stand against a wide variety of things that the government has done, both under the Obama administration and the Trump administration.
Can you think of an example?
Yes, absolutely. So Microsoft has sued over the DACA changes, the deferred...
right.
Yeah, you know that acronym.
Yes, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals.
Exactly. And so they have sued over that.
People who are brought here as minors.
Microsoft went all the way to the Supreme Court in a case over a piece of data on a data center in Ireland that the Justice Department was trying to get, saying that it was not their domain. And really, Microsoft, in a wide variety of ways, has said, hey, we are going to stand up to the government. And of course, this dates back all the way to Microsoft's own antitrust case, where they have not shied away from taking on the government. That said, in this statement, they were very clear as well that they do not offer technology that's used directly in the separation of children and families. But unlike Google, they have not yet said that they are going to do no further work with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency.
Are these the big three? I imagine this, you talked about a government contract worth billions. And is it going to Microsoft, Google, or Amazon, or someone else? And if we don't take it, they will? Or how's that going down?
If it went to someone other than these three, it would be a pretty significant surprise, because a lot of the other companies are either legacy companies like Oracle or others along those lines that have not yet gotten fully into the cloud world. These are the three big public cloud vendors, each of whom have aggressively pursued government cloud contracts. I was in Washington, D.C. a few months ago. At some of the metro stops, the amount of advertising specific to government procurement agencies, you know, in the subway stops is remarkable for both Amazon and Microsoft, specifically touting their government clouds. So this is clearly a big business with huge stakes for each of these companies.
Do you think these companies, how much do they not want to get into deciding who uses their software and how and who's good and bad?
That is a very good question, because I think they would love to avoid this entirely if they could. It's so tricky, and it's political, it's messy, it gets into areas where it's a judgment call. Some people might think that what Immigration and Customs is doing is right, even despite the backlash.
Yep.
And so they risk not only alienating some shareholders, but some employees, no matter which side of the issue they come down on. And so this is difficult. I think one of the things that came up at Google was it becomes harder and harder for companies to take public stands on social issues the bigger they get, because the chances are just that much higher that they're going to alienate a pretty significant part of their constituency.
Yeah. I wonder whether the whole Facebook Cambridge Analytica thing changed their customers' tastes for this?
I think you do have to think about what's happened with Facebook in this entire context, because there has been a great awakening among the American public, among the global population, about the reach of tech companies into our lives. And here you have yet another example where each of these companies is providing some form of technology to the government that gives them powers, that gives the government powers that it did not have before. So it's a huge issue, and I think it's an important one to talk about.
Again, we started off talking with GeekWire's Todd Bishop about the ACLU and community activists and shareholders asking Amazon to stop selling its facial recognition software to local law enforcement. Has Amazon made any official response to any of that?
Nothing official, no. But they've been very clear that this is something they're going to continue to do, and they've essentially stood by the technology and said, hey, you know, how other people use it is really up to them, and that's where the law should step in if there's a problem with how they're using it.
GeekWire's Todd Bishop, he's in a collared short-sleeved shirt. You're not naked or anything. I mean, it's not 90 degrees. It's not 100 degrees, but it's warm.
It is warm, yes. No, not in the radio studio.
Not in the studio.
I keep my clothes on here.
Yes. I respect that, and I appreciate that. I've told you time again how much that means to me. Mid-80s yesterday, I slept last night in a tent in my backyard with two of my kids. I'm telling you this because we were asking on social media, we were just talking about Facebook, do you need air conditioning in Seattle?
I've been following this at KUOW.
Okay. So Christy, born and raised here, says, got a heat pump last year, and for the first time as an adult, I don't completely hate summer. A heat pump, so you're pumping the hot air out of your place?
Well, for me, the great outdoors is the answer, much as it is.
It's a heat pump.
For you. Exactly. My wife and I were outside last night, sitting on the front deck at about 10 p.m.
Yep.
And it was perfect.
Yeah, I came in the morning to go to work to get ready for work, and man, was it hot inside my house, the tent.
Absolutely.
Very cool. Mary says, Mary came in from the Bay Area 6 years ago, says, our first two summers here were not what my husband advertised. I expected highs of 70 during the summer. I cannot take 85 plus. We spent so much money eating out on hot days in hopes that our home would be less than 80 at bedtime. It rarely helped. We had central cooling put in 3 years ago. I'm firmly in the absolutely air group. While Danny says air conditioners are for wimps. Does GeekWire take a position on this question?
No, but I do personally, having grown up in the Sacramento Valley where it can routinely get above 100, approach 110 on some days. I think people around here can be wimps. I mean, the fact that it's 85, 85, and you're talking about air conditioning, please.
Yvonne says, AC is much like the umbrella. Real Seattleites don't use them. I can't believe you said that, Yvonne. That's a can of very warm worms.
Bringing umbrellas into it now?
Yeah. And real Seattleites? That's a whole discussion on social media. What's a real Seattleite? You can go there yourself, KOW's Facebook page. We've been chatting it up with our real IRL friend, Todd Bishop, co-founder of the Seattle tech news site GeekWire. Thank you, Todd.
Anytime, Bill.
And thank you for tuning in on KOW. Our show for today, produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimma Brempong, Allison Bruzek, and Jason Pagano. Our social media producer, Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. The Week in Review is recording live Thursday evening at Bellevue Arts Museum. So we'll see you there.